And as we fade down now to the untimely end of the good ship Edmund Fitzgerald, I want to remind everybody that you've been listening to Al's Place, and you are going to be continuing to listen to KUAC FM in Fairbanks Public Radio for Alaska's Interior. Stay tuned now, please, for Home Fires in Paddy Kostelic.
Good morning, I'm Paddy Kostelic, and welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. Once again, we're talking about something that's very interesting to me. We're going to talk about historic preservation, and in the studio with me are two people who are very active in the on the Regional Council in the Western Office, but they're out-of-town guests, Nancy Shanahan and Bill Frazier, and we'll get to some of the facts about their specific background and jobs right in a minute. And also Jane Haig, who's an architectural historian and is president at the moment of the Tanana Yukon Historical Society. So we're going to talk about some of the buildings, landmarks, cabins, so on, that are in our community, as well as about the field of historic preservation. Let's start with Nancy. How did you get into this work?
A long-term interest in historic buildings and history. I majored in history in college, went to law school, worked in a private firm for a while, and I just wanted to get back into something that, get into something a little closer to my real interests. So I'm using my legal degree to promote historic preservation.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Texas.
And what? What part of Texas?
In San Antonio, which,
which has a lot of history.
When I was growing up there, they didn't quite know what to do with it. But in the past 10 years or so since I've left, they've done a lot in terms of community appreciation for what they have, and it's gained national recognition.
It's actually a very charming town. I've been through there a few times. Bill, where did you grow up?
I'm originally from Virginia.
Well, that's in our nation, that's certainly got a lot of historical buildings.
Yeah, it does. It was real interesting. My first job was working in a small town in Virginia called Stanton, and it had a dying downtown, and we tried to use the old buildings to revitalize the community. And the problem was it was a Victorian town, and in Virginia, you know, everything is colonial. So
right.
We had a real educational challenge to convince the community that the Victorian buildings were worth saving because they were so used to only saving the colonial building.
It's interesting. That is a sort of classic kind of conflict about what do we value, you know, what is interesting or what has architectural value. And just to get Jane involved in the conversation, I just found out for the first time that you're an architectural historian, because I've known you under other flags. Other titles. How did you choose that as a field?
Well, I studied architecture at the University of Oregon. I went down there to study architecture, and I had actually been living up here. And when I went there, I was very interested in studying structures and the real technical aspects of building design. But they wouldn't let me in those courses until I had been there for 2 or 3 years. I had to have prerequisites, which was very upsetting, but I found out I could take architectural history, so I did. And I was fascinated by it. It sort of brought me back to one of my things that I had always been fascinated with old houses as a child, you know, and I'm very interested in new houses, all kinds of houses. And I think it was the old houses that, you know, being interested in old houses. And then I took quite a bit of architectural history at college, and just decided to, after a while, I had so many credits that I would get my degree in architectural history, and they had a very good program and quite a bit of emphasis on historic preservation and so forth, and I've just been following that ever since.
You grew up here?
No, I grew up actually on the East Coast in Maryland. And I came up here in 1970, and there were a lot more old buildings here then than there are now, and I remember some friends of mine. Well, one group of friends tore down the Wickersham Hotel, which had been the Eagles Hall on Wickersham Street, and that was before I went away to college. And they found some amazing things in that building. And it had been the Eagles Hall, and they found the old cornice from the top of the, you know, the balcony, and the stage was still there, and it had been converted to a cold storage plant. So all of these wonderful details were beneath and inside walls and totally covered up. And you know, a couple of my friends built their houses out of that, and then some other friends tore down the Bentley barn.
Where was that?
I think it's where Fred Myers is. It was on that side of College Road.
Uh-huh.
And it was across the street from the Bentley's junkyard, mm-hmm. which was where the Bentley Mall is now.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you know, another friend of mine, I think, it got Bentley's house and took it apart log by log and moved it, but there was no real interest in historic preservation, and I didn't have any interest in documenting that kind of thing either, which I'm very sorry about now. But when I came back, you know, I began to see things in a new light. And I think it has a real parallel with what Bill says about the town in Virginia that didn't appreciate its Victorian architecture. People in Fairbanks don't appreciate log cabins because they're not Victorian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if they were Victorian, if it looked like San Francisco, they, you know, I think we could say, oh, well, we have to save that. But, you know, if it's merely a warehouse that was one of the first warehouses in Fairbanks and it's just an old tin-covered warehouse, you know, everybody goes, well, we don't need to save that. You know, mm-hmm. that's... it's not worthwhile. So I think we're in a sort of parallel situation.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about that. If we have a sort of uneducated concept, if we haven't been thinking a lot about this field, that you need some kind of monumental structure with a lot of curlicues and a lot of fancy stuff, sort of stately building, in order to be of value as a landmark. Is that your finding, Bill, in a lot of places?
Well, I think that's been the traditional view in the history of preservation. A movement started with saving great monuments, and, you know, the isolated house museum, Mount Vernon or something like that. And I think we've seen so much change in the last 20 or 30 years with the movement across the country, realizing that the value in preserving neighborhoods and whole commercial districts, and if you only save one or two significant buildings, you're really losing the continuity that a good community has, and you're losing that sense of connection between generations. And so we're seeing that every town doesn't have a Mount Vernon, but it has a lot of other history that really is the valid statement of its past. And I think it's really important to recognize what is your past and appreciate it. And, of course, Alaska has such an incredibly rich history in its short settlement patterns that... there is a lot of fascinating history to preserve, and I think it's a matter. The challenge is to identify what is old and worthy of saving, realizing you can't save everything, nor should you. And once you can get agreement on what's there and some agreement on which things you should try to save after they've been identified, then you need to, I think, really educate the community about their history. Sometimes it's hard to tell how valuable something is.
So we could be too close to it.
That's true.
To be able to recognize it. Before we specifically get in to some more detailed parts of this discussion, I'd like to keep it a little bit general first and talk about the historic preservation movement, and sort of say that it seems fairly new, which is not to say that there weren't organizations that have been for a long time interested in preserving historical monuments. But when I went to Europe the first time in the 60s, was a really different feeling in terms of the way they value the buildings, and they don't change them, and there's a lot of history that they encounter every day on their normal walks and movements. And here we have this sort of new feeling in America, and that change is always very good, and that progress is really the most important progress is our most important product. And so I think it's probably been only a recent awareness by larger groups of people that this is worth doing, maybe from the bicentennial interest that occurred. Or has this been a growing movement, or has it been...
Well, I think that the bicentennial was certainly one of the most visible events that focused the nation's attention on historic preservation. I think we've seen in the last decade or so a real change across the country at every level in interest in preservation. The bicentennial helped on that. I think we've seen the throughout governmental structure, setting up a National Register of Historic Places, a listing of landmarks that's run through state governments to the Department of Interior, has really focused attention on the formal process. And there have been a lot of incentives that have just come out, tax incentives that assist. So you're seeing a lot of buildings get preserved that even 5 or 10 years ago would not have been. So you're seeing all across society, I think, interest in the private sector, the bicentennial tax changes in tax laws, so on. And the market is responding. And cities throughout the country, there's you know, the historic now shopping core you see from Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco to
Seattle has a lot of
Pioneer Square.
Pioneer Square is a really excellent example of that. And I read an article about the individuals that sort of put that together, and there were lots of parts that needed to be fitted in to make that work. So that our audience feels free to join us in this conversation or ask my guests any questions that you might have. Our number is 474-5044. And if you have any curiosity or special interest, please feel free to call. That number is 474-5044. All right, the organization that you are part of, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, is a nonprofit. It's not a federal agency. And when did it start?
Started in 1949, I believe, 59.
49.
49. We're actually chartered by Congress. It was in reaction at the time to, I think, some loss of some very significant buildings in the East, and a time when, you know, I decided, you know, it's time to take a serious look at historic resources. And really the first act told the federal agencies and the federal government that in your activities in the nation, don't do anything to destroy the historic past. And that's sort of, you know, where the movement, as far as the legal aspect of it, started.
When did the National Register officially start?
That was through the National Preservation Act of 1966.
It's relatively recent.
It really is. The United States was one of the last remaining democracies in the Western Hemisphere not to have a National Historic Preservation sort of formal program. So we are very young at this.
That's right.
I'd just like to mention that preservation activities had started before that, specifically, I think, with a group that was founded to save Mount Vernon, which was early in this century. And then the Rockefellers got involved in Williamsburg, which is, of course, one of the biggest preservation efforts ever. And they put a lot of their money behind preservation. And, you know, through their activities in preserving some of the buildings at Williamsburg, people got started on the kind of research and getting the kind of experience that it takes to document these kind of buildings. And then there was a whole someplace to go to see what preservation was about. But, of course, that got people stuck in the idea that it, only if it was colonial should you preserve it. And then there were probably many, many groups, you know, even at that time that had historic houses and a single building like, you know, in the New England states that they were preserving. And some of the early architectural historians were documenting the early houses in Connecticut and some of the colonial houses and so forth. And that kind of research was going on in the 30s, documenting those kind of buildings. But it all kind of coalesced, I think, when the National Trust was formed and, you know, when the National Register was founded to bring all of these local resources together. And, you know, another interesting thing is that during the Depression, one of the CCC projects were local state tours in which they actually documented a number of buildings, too. And the National Park Service had a number of buildings that they were preserving and so forth, too.
First, I think that most of us think in... Let me back up here. I grew up in Illinois from the time I was 12, and that's called the Land of Lincoln. So every building that Lincoln ever slept in has some interest to the local people. And in Urbana, Illinois, where I mostly grew up, they had the hotel that Lincoln slept in. And even though, and several times when he was riding circuit, so it wasn't just one night, and it was a nice old hotel. And then when they came in to do a shopping mall down there, they sort of built it onto the hotel, which looks really strange from the outside, but is actually quite nice on the inside. But that shows that we are valuing some buildings simply because of the important personages, the movers and shakers that are documented in more normal history, that they had a connection to those buildings. But that's a sort of different issue than the value, the architectural value of the building itself, regardless of who was in that building or used that building or what the purpose of that building was. Let's talk about what the requirements are to become a national, to put a property on the National Register of Historic Places.
Right. Well, as I alluded to earlier, that's a government program. And when they set up the Historic Preservation Act, they invited states to participate. And so the states get some small federal funds, and they do a lot of the work, and then they send it into the Department of Interior that maintains this listing, the National Register. Mm-hmm. The important thing about the National Register when it was set up in 1966 and really late 60s was that for the first time properties were eligible if they were important not only nationally but statewide and regionally and locally. So for the first time, if your building was important locally, it could be listed. And before that, we had only one program called National Historic Landmarks, and that was the Monticello's and the Mount Vernon. So this really has resulted in literally hundreds of thousands of buildings across the United States now listed individually or throughout a district. And it's a combination of the, as you said, the history of the associations that are associated with the building as well as the architecture. It can be predominantly one or the other. It can be both. Just for its architectural style, or if an interesting architect built it, or if it's part of the history of the community that's very important. It can be a very plain building, but that's an industrial building, but it's very important in the history to the town or the city or the county. So it doesn't have to be just architecture. It can be both.
Jane, do architectural historians have a hard time convincing populations of a building's historical value as architecture? Is that a...
Well, I think Bill hit on a good point, and you did too, that the simply being of significance in relation to a significant person in the history of even the local community is enough to have a building recognized on the National Register. It doesn't have to be of architectural significance, and there is not much in Alaska as a whole that's, you know, of significance architecturally on a national level. Although there are certainly representations of different architectural styles here, and luckily in the last 5 or 10 years there's been a sort of a new field in architectural history, which is the study of vernacular architecture. And vernacular is, I think it means of the people, and it recognizes the significance not only of monuments, not only of Lincoln memorials and mansions mm-hmm. and so forth, but of the local kinds of things local people build, like, for instance, pueblos. You know, a pueblo is simply its habitation. It's the kinds of things that people built for themselves, and vernacular architecture can be everything from a nice barn to, you know, apartment houses or, you know, the kind of log cabins that we have here. And, you know, or I think it started when Robert Venturi studied the Las Vegas Strip architecture.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote a book called Learning from Las Vegas, in which he really got people to look at what is around you. And people started studying diners and white tower hamburgers and you know, the kinds of things that we see around us locally, and writing about them and saying, well, you know, these things are significant because this is what we have. And, you know, if, like, I remember when I went to Europe, I mean, a part of Europe that's especially charming is the villages. And mm-hmm. even the farming villages, with the way that they build the barns and the way that their houses are and the way that they have a particular way that they built them, you know, in a particular time period. And we're fascinated by this, and someday people will be fascinated by what we built. They'll be fascinated by ranch houses and the derivation of it and how people came to build that way. And luckily
that's split levels.
You know, I don't know what kind of significance they're going to derive from this, but I think that the fact that people are becoming aware of this makes it easier to see what we have in that kind of context is important.
Yeah. I think before we get off the topic of the National Register of Historic Places, I think it's important to note that the meaning of this listing to an individual property owner, if you own a property that's listed on the National Register, it really does not restrict what that property owner can do to his or her property. What it does is, one, it makes available federal tax incentives if that property owner desires to put that property to some income-producing use. In addition, what it does, and this is the most significant thing, is that it protects that property from actions that the federal government may take, the federal projects, federally funded projects. But as far as an individual property owner, listing on the National Register sometimes seems something like scary. Oh, no, somebody's going to tell me what I can or can't do with my property. It doesn't. It does not do that.
I would have thought that it would enhance the value.
In many cases, it does. In many cases, it does.
It just depends on what it is. Bill made the point, and I think this is a point well taken, that Fairbanks, we're sort of living in the first chapter of settlement. Now, that seems, it just depends on whether you're going to look at this as a long chapter or a short chapter. But there are people that I've had on this show who have lived here for 40 or 50 years who've seen tremendous changes, and some of the buildings are still here. That the organizing impetus around Alaska Land was some attempt to sort of put some of those very early buildings at the time that a lot of them were being torn down in one place, and cabins are fairly easily moved. And it's hard to see when it's just the beginning and it's so rudimentary. In Oklahoma, the dugout houses, which seem so rude and unpleasant, and I know a lot of the people who experienced them said, why save that? That was such an unpleasant experience. But it's fascinating now to look at a few of those.
But as a visitor coming here, you know, I wonder, well, here they are in Alaska Land, but where did they come from? How did they fit into the overall community? You know, why are they moved off to some little a place like Disneyland
artificial
that we look at? You know, what were they? Where were they? And I think you lose a lot if your solution is always to move the building off to Alaska Land.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings up another point, and I think that communities need to look at what their older resources mean to the economy of the community. And I think, you know, you have to say tourism. What about tourism? Visitors like me. You know, I come here and I want to see the past. I want to see what it was like in the past. I want to see that character. And if it's gone, I'm going to say, well, what? Well, you know, why are we here? Let's not go to Fairbanks. Let's go somewhere else.
I guess Jane could speak to the issues of compromise that are involved here or decision-making that's involved here. Because if someone has a downtown property with a tiny little one-room cabin, it may or may not be very comfortable, habitable. It may be of great historic interest, but it may not be something that you want to live in today. And so what do? There you have a lot.
That's a problem. You know, and I think we're seeing various solutions to it. A lot of people just tear down the cabins and build a fourplex, you know. Some of them aren't so nice looking either. Some of them are, but of course, if you go to a realtor, they're going to tell you the highest and best use of your property is not to have that little cabin there. And, you know, it's a problem. The little cabins, there's not that many people that really want to live like that. They're, you know, of course, there's always some, but, you know, property owners are always going to complain that if you prohibit them from taking the cabin down, you're destroying their property value. Mm-hmm. But there must be some compromise solution here. Some way to preserve some of the cabins or to make a historic district a place that, you know, where some of the cabins can be preserved and to preserve the ambience of the neighborhoods and so forth and still allow people perhaps to add on or to somehow change the structures within some guidelines that preserve the mm-hmm. general appearance of the neighborhood.
We still do have enough cabins and old homes that have some historical value that we have a walking tour, I know, in, mm-hmm. in the summer, and that it isn't a long walking tour, and you can see quite a few interesting sites down there. But I think it is changing, and it's something that, you know, each year we lose a few more.
Maybe, you know, at the same time that not too many people would like to live in those little cabins, you could also say the corollary is, well, there'll always be somebody that wants to live in little cabins like that. And, you know, if they have a value to the community, maybe there's some way to give people some credit on their local taxes that will offset the losses that they'll incur by not developing the property. Maybe there's some way to have, monetarily place, tell people that we place a value locally on some of these neighborhoods being left the way that they are.
I'm not sure what the property tax rate is in Fairbanks. Do either of you know? Is it significant?
It's about, 7 or 8 mils, 10 mils, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that in the state of Alaska, there is a state statute which allows local governments, if properties are listed in local historic districts, it allows, for instance, the city of Fairbanks to completely exempt those properties from taxation. So that is a significant incentive that could be provided if the city desired to do so. There's another statute that says that for any improvements made on properties within local historic districts, the improvements won't be taxed.
Mm-hmm.
They won't increase taxes to cover those improvements. So there are some incentives in that way, and I don't know how they would work in your particular community, but these are available.
The other thing to look at is that if people are using the properties for income-producing purposes, which I guess in some cases could include rental units, and if they were in a local historic district, there's a state revolving loan fund that could provide funding. So there would be some offsetting benefits and tax incentives. Nancy's going to tell us a little bit more about some of the tax credits that are available for historic properties, too. So, I think first it's a matter of the community saying, well, we do place a value on these kind of neighborhoods because tourists love to see the east side and the west side with all the fences and the sweet peas and the delphiniums in the summer.
And
the log cabins. And it's just really charming. And I think if we don't have any of that, if we just have split-level ranch houses,
we might as well go to Southern California
and
see that.
We'd have better weather, but more traffic. I have several friends that live in the downtown area. When we have really heavy ice fog and when it's so dark and cold and it's so hard to start cars, which is not, thankfully, true this winter and certainly not today, but when all those things are a problem, there's some real advantages to living downtown and not having to start the car every day and being able to walk around and get where you want to go easily. And there is a lot of charm, I know, to just living down there and being able to walk by people's gardens right in the middle of town and so on. That's really pleasant. Let's talk a little bit about the two surveys that were done. There was a borough survey done of...
the first survey that was done was, we did in 1978, and it was done by Janet Matheson under contract with the city. And I helped her on that survey. And it was, I think, the first survey of historic buildings in Alaska in a city. We were starting from scratch, and we thought, when we estimated how many, what kind of survey we were going to design and how long it was going to take, that we would find 50 or 60 buildings, that were older than 50 years and that we would describe, or have to put pictures of in our proposed publication. And we found over 500 buildings. And it was kind of a madhouse of inventory forms and documentation and photographs and trying to figure out exactly what it was we had, how old these buildings were. And most of the records that the city had kept had been lost in the flood.
Mm-hmm.
And so the assessor's records merely reflected a guess on the part of the assessors when they reconstructed them in 1967. And we spent a lot of time in the archives, and we interviewed a lot of pioneers, and we found out that for almost every block, there's one person still around that knew who lived there and when they built which house and had some basic information. And the pioneers we couldn't have done it without the pioneers. Mm-hmm. They were a tremendous help. And we found at least four places where Noel Ween lived.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out that there was a famous bush pilot that lived on almost every little cabin downtown. There was some person that was really significant to our local history that lived in almost every house, and they all had stories. And we had a lot of fun, but when it came time to writing it all up, it was just a tremendous amount of information in a real limited amount of time. And I attempted to put together some kind of analysis of what kind of houses we had and how they came to get here. I looked all summer for a set of house plans for even one house in Fairbanks, and I didn't find any.
They do them on napkins.
They do them the same way we build houses today, you know. So-and-so built a house last summer for somebody, and he'll do you a nice house. So they drew a house, plan on a napkin, and they built it, and that was that. Except for the F.E. Company houses.
Uh-huh.
The White House, which is a convent by Monroe School, they had plans for that. That was a colonial revival house that was designed on the East Coast in Boston. And the F.E. Company still has plans for every building that they built here. Mm. But those were the only ones. But there were a variety of different kinds of houses. There are cabins, and then a lot of the kinds of houses that were, I call stick-style houses, that were built when the railroad came in, mm-hmm. in the 20s. And everything got modified pretty much in the 40s and 50s. There's a lot of post-war sort of styles of houses built in the late 40s and 50s, you know, after the post-war population started to increase and so forth, too.
When there's money in a community, and there was a lot of money in Fairbanks in the early part of this century, of course, there's a lot of guilt that comes along with that. Guilt, as in G-I-L-T, not, mm-hmm. not guilt over having money. And in reading some of the books, for example, Joanne Wold's This Old House, it seemed that downtown, I mean, they had some very elaborate dances, dance halls, very elegant affairs, things that were much more elaborate than most of the socializing things that we do now. And in reading it, it was hard for me to sort of picture what it must have been like, because it's very different than what downtown looks like now. I couldn't even exactly imagine where some of those buildings were.
Well, the Eagles Hall that I was telling you about was one of the places that they had a lot of the dances, and it was very elaborate, and there's quite a few pictures of the inside of it. For instance, they had the early Tenenbaum Valley Fairs there, and they have a lot of pictures of that whole Eagles Hall full of cabbages and potatoes, uh-huh. and displays and so forth, too. And they had a roller rink and an indoor swimming pool and all kinds of things. And they had lots and lots of plays and musical entertainments and socials, and they had a couple different bands of various persuasions, uh-huh. and all kinds of activities. And I think a lot more individual commercial stores and storefronts, mm-hmm. downtown, too.
And the famous line.
And the 4th Avenue line, yeah.
Which was where the prostitution was carried out. And
yeah.
It was behind it. It was really right downtown, but there was a sort of clapboard fence around it, and you had to go through a gate on both ends.
Yeah, it was right on 4th Avenue, I think, where Penny's is now. And a lot of the cabins at Alaskaland are actually from the line. They're the old, they used to call them cribs, and they're the little log cabins that have a great big picture window and a door. And the girls would sit in the window.
I still do that in Amsterdam.
Yes.
And, yeah, there's still a couple of those cabins down on 4th Avenue, on the west end of 4th Avenue, that are, I don't know if they're still there. They were there a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh. And she was talking about having to walk past
the gate. Uh-huh.
And delivering papers, who got to deliver papers to the line and so on.
I don't know if you know, but that old house that she talks about is still there. It's on 2nd Avenue. And the bathhouse, let's see, this old house was about Clara Rust,
mm-hmm.
and her husband, Jess Rust, his mother ran the bathhouse that's now the Oddfellows Hall. Actually, it's the Rebecca's Hall. It's been taken mm-hmm. over by the Rebecca's. It's on 1st Avenue. And they've just painted that and spiffed it up a little bit. And the house, the little cabin behind that, is the cabin that Clara and Jess first lived in, that is the subject of this old house. So that's, you know, certainly...
She was always trying to get him to make improvements on it, and they were real slow in coming. Things don't change too much.
Yeah, later on they built a house on 8th Avenue, and mm-hmm. that is not there anymore. I think that was torn down.
I don't know if our out-of-town guests are aware. We have a sort of idea in Fairbanks that the ability to build a dwelling comes in the genetic encoding. And so we have a lot of people who, with very little experience, just get some, call it the board of the month plan, and just get some boards and nails and go to it. Part of that comes out of the fact that that money from banks, traditional home building loans, have been difficult when you are talking about a piece of land that's on permafrost that has no access to electricity. Bankers, as you know, are very conservative. If you're a banker out there, you want to call call me and object to that, you can do that at 474-5044. But they go by some national codes about what you need in order to loan money on a building project. And, of course, not everybody in the Fairbanks area has land and access to those sort of services that would qualify. And so then your only recourse is to pay for the thing as you go. And it can result in some fairly ingenious and really lovely structures, and also some problems. But if you've made the problems, I guess you can undo them and start again. What, in your survey, what were some of the main finds downtown? Of course, the old courthouse building, which...
Well, there's quite a few buildings that were on the National Register, even at the time that we did the survey. And the federal building, which was built in the 30s, is on the National Register, and that's recently been restored by the SADAR Corporation. And that's of a monumental quality, and that's a really wonderful Art Deco-style building with some wonderful fixtures in it and so forth. It's really nice. And, a lot of us probably remember when that was the post office, and which is kind of a shame it's not the post office anymore. But it's been nicely done. And there are two houses on Cowell Street. One is called the Mary Lee Davis House, and that was built in the, between 1910 and 1920. There's also a house across the street from that called the Falcon Joslin House, and Falcon Joslin was the promoter or railroad man who came up in around 1906 and built the Tanana Valley Railroad. And he built the two-story house on Cowell's at, I think it's 5th or 6th. That's a big square house, kind of like you would see in the Midwest. It's a big four-square, two-story house. And it's very formal, and he lived there for only a few years. The house is now owned by Hugh Connolly. The story was that Falcon Joslin's wife refused to live in Fairbanks and moved to Seattle, and eventually so did he. And the Mary Lee Davis house was a similar story. A man had quite a bit of money and wanted his wife to move to Fairbanks, and she said she would only marry him and move to Fairbanks if he would build a house that was fitting of her, and she had a Seattle architect design it, and I think she sort of had her lawyer approve the plans as part of the marriage contract, but...
Covering all bases.
He died shortly after the house was built, and she sold it and moved away, and that was a... But that's a wonderful old house. And, of course, the Masonic Temple, I think, is on the National Register, and the Oddfellows Hall, too.
And the McGowan.
And, well, the library, and the George library. C. Thomas Library, which is on 1st and Cowles, which was the original library in Fairbanks, and a sort of a miner's retreat where they could have a good smoke and read a good book. And that still has all of the old tin ceilings in it and so forth. And there's a number of other buildings in town that may be potentially eligible for the register, like the Lazy Street Theater and the Empress Theater, which is Co-op Drugstore, and the NC Company buildings, which is now Nordstrom's, which were the original commercial buildings in Fairbanks. The NC Company bought out Captain Barnett in 1903, the year after Barnett established his cash, and those buildings have been there and growing as a mercantile establishment ever since then. And the NC Company warehouses, which are behind Samson's Hardware. Samson's Hardware itself.
Yes, I've seen some old pictures of Fairbanks, and there's Samson's Hardware.
Samson's Hardware has been right on that spot.
And the church across the street,
and the Immaculate Conception Church, which was originally built across the river, and they moved it.
Really?
They moved it across the river in the winter.
That's amazingly large building to move.
And, of course, they had the hospital behind the church, which they tore down the older frame part of the hospital a number of years ago. But the church is on the National Register, too.
Considering the number of fires and floods that, you know, any frontier town built on a river has had, I think we have an amazing number of structures still preserved.
And yeah, there are. There's quite a number.
And I don't know whether that was local planning or just... That they stayed. That brings us, I guess, back to what the National Trust for Historic Preservation can do to help local communities preserve what we have. I read some of the literature that you brought. It is a nonprofit. It has members that join for memberships. But in looking through the information, it was amazing to me how technical and how many parts how many pieces of information, how much expertise, the expertise of architects who can talk about the, what do I want to say, the structural integrity and know how to make things safe and also preserve what counts, but also a lot of legal things and zoning issues come in to this, and you have amassed all this information.
Well, yeah, the preservation, as you just said, Patty, really reflects everything from law to architecture and history and real estate development and obviously economics and the technical aspects of historic materials and whole area of research. So it really does cover a lot of different fields. The National Trust is really set up as a sort of a nonprofit clearinghouse of information and assistance. We've got 6 regional offices in the United States, and ours in San Francisco covers 9 states in the West, from Arizona up here to Alaska, from Hawaii back to Nevada and Utah, and Idaho, and so on, and the coast. And we do field visits as a limited staff can of 9 people and go throughout the region and encourage state and local organizations to take advantage of their own history and try to help them.
We have a caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
Oh, okay, I can't hear you very well.
Okay.
Well, I'm at home here working on a problem, as you were just discussing. And but I wondered if your guest had ever done anything on some of the old equipment that was, that's sitting around Alaskaland, for instance, the steam shovel. I think some of that equipment might also have interesting stories behind it, as well as some of our buildings.
Jane?
We're all looking at each other here.
I'm going to have to find some equipment experts and bring them on the show.
The equipment is, you know, it is interesting. And I was going to say, I don't know whether equipment can be on the National Register, but that issue was addressed with the gold dredges. There are a couple gold dredges on the National Register, and including the one in Fox, which recently got on the register. But I don't know if there's a size, you know, that the equipment has to be of a certain size to be on it. Do you know anything about that, Nancy?
I don't know of any specific listings like mm-hmm. it, but you know, I think it kind of falls under the category of urban archaeology that there are a number of publications about, especially recently.
Yeah. So, the whole National Register says not only buildings, sites, districts, and objects.
Right, and objects, and you know, maybe it would be like designating a site where this equipment had been or had been used. You designate the whole site, and as part of that designation, you know, would be the equipment that is still there.
Yeah, well, the cable cars, for example, are on the National Register. There are a lot of ships that are now and boats that are on the mm-hmm. National Register, mm-hmm. and a lot of industrial complexes that have all
mills,
kinds of original mills and equipment.
Stuff.
Lighthouses,
and
mills.
Sure.
That's right. And a lot of it depends, you know, its significance also relates to what's still there in terms of the original equipment.
So were you talking, caller, about the... at Alaskaland, some of the equipment there at Alaskaland?
Some of the equipment that's around there is fairly old, or it appears to be fairly old. And, for instance, in terms of that steam shovel, I don't know anything about that particular one. But there was equipment like that was brought into Alaska to build the Alaska Railroad, and it had been used prior to that to build the Panama Canal. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of things like that might have quite a history behind them.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
That's one thing I think we have a fairly good chance in Alaska of preserving, because most people leave all the equipment they've ever used in their yard, so we we may have a jump on that.
That's right. There's a lot of stuff that came here and stayed.
That's true. It usually doesn't leave once it gets here. I was going to say there's one proposal to make Alaskaland itself a historic district, because there are so many historic objects there. Although, since they were all moved there and it's not the original site of anything, that there's some technical problems to that. The other thing I've been thinking lately is that historic districts deal mostly with buildings, and historic objects have always been the provenance of museums. In fact, there are some museum villages that have been created in which the concept of living history is coming to be important, mm-hmm. and people actually demonstrate and use the objects in the way that they were used in the past. And that's sort of a combination between historic preservation and a museum. And to me, a lot of the things in Alaskaland are of a museum quality, including some of the small houses. There certainly are museums, like the Smithsonian has a number of small houses within it. And, you know, Alaskan certainly has the potential of being a museum village, and it certainly should have a historical curator to care for not only the objects within the Pioneers Museum, but all of the objects.
And an active interpretive program.
Yeah, to really tell people how they were used or perhaps demonstrate it and so forth.
Bill was giving me a list before we went on the air of really the elements that you need to do some coherent and coherent preservation of a downtown area or of any area that you want to preserve. What were those elements?
Well, traditionally, the first thing to do is find out what you've got, and that's Jane talked about having the survey, and that's certainly the first step, and you have to periodically update surveys, and I think you're getting ready to do that as well. You get new information at different times, and then once you've identified what you have that's important, then you've got to figure out ways of trying to preserve it, and I think the real challenge is to educate the town or the county or the area and the residents of what's historical in our area. It's hard to convince people that they should preserve something if they don't know why it's important or what history is associated with it. So you've got to do some outreach and education to the community. And then once I think people understand that they own something that is historic, they look at it maybe a little differently than just another piece of property. And ideally they begin to feel a sense of responsibility to pass that piece of history on in the future. There are a lot of tools and techniques, incentives and regulations to help do that.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Patty. Enjoying your show this morning.
Thank you.
Hey, there's a whole other view of Fairbanks when you float down the river, the Chena, that is.
That's true.
And that's a perspective that might be helpful in terms of historic preservation planning in the future, is trying to recreate that sense of what Fairbanks looks like and how it's perceived from the river. So I just wanted to throw that out for anyone on when the ice goes out, and if they want to float down the river, they can get a perspective of what E.T. Barnett may have dreamed of.
Right. Well, Fairbanks was started because E.T. couldn't, the water level went down and E.T. couldn't get any farther with his supplies. And in fact, until more recent times, that is the way traditionally people arrived with the larger stuff, at least, was by river. And so, yes, we are built along the river. And there was a survey done along the 40 mile, right, of historic cabins and...
I think that there was, yeah. I've never seen it. I'm not familiar with it.
We have a tradition of river transportation in the interior, and if you've looked at a map, you see that we really do still have very few roads.
And you know, once again, this takes us to Alaskan, where the riverboat Nanana is, and I'm sure we're all familiar with the pictures of the waterfront in Fairbanks. And seeing those steamboats in the Chena River, and they were so huge in comparison to the size of the town.
Of them.
And there were four, five, six of them tied up at one time right in front of the NC Company docks, right at the bridge. And I think that this caller had a really good point. And, you know, the riverboat discovery has really demonstrated the potential of the river as a tourism kind of experience. And I think there's a lot more potential for a tour downtown, you know, a downtown riverboat kind of experience that would really... I mean, coming... It'd be so wonderful to come from, say, Alaskan, even into Fairbanks on a riverboat.
Which is the way people used to
That's
come.
That's right, yeah.
And it is
we
very,
have to,
very
we have to
different.
Do something about the bridge for the coal over to MUS is the only problem.
Cut down on traffic and
just
reinstitute some river traffic. And that is it. And actually... that point about the river is a point talking about preservation. What was the historic background of this community and looking at all its resources? And the point that you made earlier is that really you can't do good historic preservation without some real local commitment and involvement and knowledge. But you've got the tools that you bring to us, but we really have to learn how to use those tools.
Right, yeah. Communities across the country are preserving, you know, a little bit or a lot of their history, depending on the local interest and local commitment. And the buildings are at the local level. We always sit at the National Trust, and that's where the folks are who should feel that they are important or not important in their lives. So we try to just provide the technical assistance and information and travel around and encourage people and let them know what other communities and towns throughout the West are doing and have done. Mm-hmm. And try to spark more enthusiasm for that in each visit. And we really appreciate having this opportunity today.
Well, I think we all like to feel connected to the place we live, even those of us who do a little more wandering, that's one way of sort of giving the community its individual identity and sort of acknowledging the roots or origins. And I think you've made the point real well this morning that it doesn't have to be a monumental building to trigger all sorts of thoughts or curiosities about our local history.
Right. Well, when we go across the United States today and we're in the, we're plugged in through cable TV and national newspapers now, that we all experience the same influences in our life. We go to the same chain restaurants. We stay in the same chain motels. You lose that regional or local character and flavor. And each country has, from the adobes of the Southwest to the brick houses of the East to the log cabins of the Pacific Northwest and Alaska. We all have that unique character that we somehow lose something of ourselves, I think, in our states and regions if we allow that to be lost.
To just constantly bulldoze down
and build the same kind of new building that you see in Dallas or Houston or Chicago or anywhere else. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we go the way of only shopping malls, I think it really affects the quality of life, and obviously shopping malls have their point, and especially to be able to shop indoors in Fairbanks when the weather is bad, there's some real pleasures to it, and I think that's one of the reasons they're so popular, the convenient, you park your car in one place and you can go, but I think that there's something that we miss if that becomes our total environment.
You know, one of the things about shopping malls we've been talking about is that shopping malls are not only convenience, but they're a marketing approach. And maybe Bill could tell us a little bit more about the Main Street project that the National Trust has, in which they try to take that marketing approach and apply it to a downtown.
Oh, yeah, we have a special program for smaller communities, for the commercial areas of small towns. We started in the Midwest and saw a lot of downtowns deteriorating and realized that, in fact, we looked at the shopping center for a model of good management because they are well managed and they do good business recruitment and good promotions, and trying to take some of their techniques into a downtown and providing a full-time manager to do that, and then building on the unique character of the historic buildings, develop a new sense of revitalization. And we've done this in 30 towns around the United States now, and after 3 years, we've seen about $150 million of development in those 30 towns. So we've seen an average of $5 million of renovation and new construction, using the historical flavor as a revitalization economic development tool. So it can happen. It's not necessarily for every community, but we've gotten some interest in Alaska, and we have a person in our office that runs that program, and I'm sure she'll be coming up here in the coming months to talk to a number of communities about that. And it's been very successful, and it's based on the self-help principle of it's incremental and it's got to be a local commitment, and it's not any kind of a big grant program. It's just the opposite. You have to commit funds to get a local manager in to do that work, and it's been extremely successful.
I'd like to ask Bill a question. Does that commitment have to come from a local? You said it had to come locally, but would that have to be from a local government entity, or could it be like from the merchants themselves, individual merchants themselves, downtown people?
Right. The Main Street concept is based on the partnership. It has to be the local merchants and owners and the buildings, and it has to be the local government. Neither one can do it alone. We've seen pragmatically you need a partnership of government and private sector to make it really work well.
And you need to reassure the local business people that, in fact, there can be profit in preservation.
I think anywhere you visit in the United States today, you're seeing that happen all across the country, of incredible economic revitalization through using historic structures. And the popularity of large corporations are now marketing a lot of things by using historic preservation.
That as expensive as restoration is, new building construction is also expensive, and square foot per square foot...
Yeah, that varies case by case. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the older building to renovate is cheaper because you've got a nice structure there. If it's in poor condition or you're changing the use radically, sometimes it's more expensive. Mm-hmm. It really varies. It's hard to say.
And although some of those downtown spaces may not be suitable for the large stores because they have different needs, there are businesses that can be well served downtown. You were saying financial interests, specialty shops.
Sure, entertainment, professional offices, and so on. We're seeing that the downtowns have that incredible investment in infrastructure, streets, roads, and all that stuff. And you can really capitalize on remembering that you are the financial center, you're the government center, you're the commercial professional center, and some of the major retail centers may move outside, and that's logical anytime you're growing. But there's a lot of uses that you can still keep in a downtown.
In traveling around the country, I've seen a growing number, despite the code problems that they probably run into, a growing number of really elegant restaurants in old homes, which creates a very pleasant atmosphere. It's dining out, dining at home. It sends that home-cooked message just instantly.
Right. Well,
yeah.
We've got the pump house.
We've got the pump house.
Yeah,
that's
we're
right.
Going
actually,
there tonight. Yeah.
You know, there's a huge range of places, even in Fairbanks, that have been established in a lot of the old Effie Company structures. In fact, almost every one of them now has a restaurant. And, you know, I think we all go out to eat for the ambience as much as for the food.
Mm-hmm. And we don't want to just only eat in concrete block structures that have some kind of stuff hung on the wall.
But one reason we're here, Bill and I are here, is for a conference on the federal tax incentives that are available to building owners to do that sort of thing, restaurants or other businesses in historic buildings, or just older buildings. They don't even have to be recognized as significant. Just
you want to run through
very brief details. 15% of the amount that an owner spends on the rehabilitation of a building 30 years or older can be written off as a tax credit that comes off the bottom line of the taxes that are owed. A building older than or 40 years or older, a 20% tax credit is allowed. And if the building owner has a historic building, the type we're talking about, the tax credit amount is 25%. So there are some significant incentives available. In the past years, since 1976, when the federal incentives were first enacted, over $7.8 billion has been invested in this type of rehab activity.
Yes, billion.
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 In the United States.
So that's a real incentive. You don't just have to love the building. It can make good economic sense. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I had a couple of questions. I have some association with historic preservation. I just come up here from Washington, D.C., where there was a big issue over a structure called Rhodes Tavern in the development of the Pennsylvania Avenue area. And the question came up about fabric. How much fabric do you really need to proclaim a structure as a historic structure?
You mean what percent of the building has to be still there?
Well, it's an interesting case where you can have a site where many famous things occurred, and then over time, as a building or a structure changes, you may end up with, you know, maybe a lintel or a foundation, yet it's easily considered a historic structure and can be entered on the record.
Maybe Nancy can address that, how much of it has
to
be there.
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the individual site. I mean, as we indicated before, a site can be listed on the National Register and it can be a site where a building used to be. If that site, was a place where significant events took place. If the structure itself is what's significant architecturally or whatever, then, you know, again, it's a case-by-case determination, but I think a significant amount of that structure would have to be still there in its, basic original form.
We're about to run out of time. In case we have generated some questions in some people's minds, is there a number, a person to get in touch with? Janet, I know Matheson is our local, is a representative for...
She's an advisor for the National Trust.
And Janet is an architect, local architect, in the phone book. Or they could contact Jane Haig as president of Tanana Yukon Historical Society.
That's right, yeah.
And I thank my guests, Bill Fraser and Nancy Shanahan and Jane Haig, for being with me. If you have questions, I hope you will get involved locally. I think that we've certainly made that point strongly, that this can't work without serious and committed local involvement. And so I hope that you will be involved in preserving the wonderful architectural integrity of our community of Fairbanks. I'm Patty Kostelic for Home Fires Radio Show. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella. I hope you have a lovely weekend, a nice mild week, and look forward to talking to you next week.
You're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's 12 noon.
Support for this program is provided by NPR member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation for coverage of events in Central America, TRW Incorporated, developer of advanced space electronics and information systems, and for international news coverage, the German Marshall Fund of the United States. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, this is National Public Radio's presentation of another in the continuing series of broadcasts from the National Press Club. I'm Michael Richards. Today's guest speaker is Florida Representative Claude Pepper.
Good afternoon. May I have your attention, please? Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is David Hess of Knight Ritter Newspapers, and I'm the president of the club. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are listening to this program over one of the 303 national public radio stations, or watching on one of the 1,800 cable systems affiliated with C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network. Before going any further, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming events. Our luncheon scheduled for Thursday, that is tomorrow on January 31st, with Ambassador Edward Rowney had to be canceled, and we regret any inconvenience this may have caused. This Friday, the day after tomorrow, on February 1st, our guest will be the President-elect of Brazil, His Excellency Tancredo Neves. Other speakers next month will be the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico, on Thursday, February the 7th, and then Judy Goldsmith and Reverend Jerry Falwell, who will share the NPC podium on Tuesday, February 12th. I'd also like to remind our guests that tape cassettes of today's program will be available from the Press Club's library this afternoon. I'd also like to point out to the audience at this point that if you have any questions for our speaker today, and I trust that you will, please write them on the cards furnished to you at your tables and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time allows. I'd like to introduce the guests at our head table now and ask them please to stand briefly when their names are read, and I'll also ask the audience to withhold its applause until I've read all the names. To my left, Larry Lippman of Cox Newspapers, Ricardo Zaldivar of Knight Ritter Newspapers, Ike Pappas, CBS News, the Honorable John J. Rockefeller, U.S. Senator from West Virginia and former governor of that state, Catherine Kaler, Newhouse News Service and Chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, the Honorable Paul Simon, United States Senator from Illinois. Senator Simon, by the way, will have to be leaving a little early today, but welcome, sir. The Honorable Raul Martinez, the Mayor of Hialeah, Florida. Warren O'Reilly, feature writer and member of our Speakers Committee who organized today's luncheon. Bob Kerr, NBC News. And Tom Rahm of the Associated Press. Today's speaker, Claude Denson Pepper, was born on a farm in Alabama, educated at Harvard, and has become the most famous Floridian since Ponce de Leon. He began practicing law in Perry, Florida, in 1925. After a term in the Florida House of Representatives, he was elected in 1936 to the United States Senate, barely 11 years after arriving in Florida. While an undergraduate in Boston, Senator Pepper volunteered as a subject for a hypnotist. He was instructed, while in a trance, to pretend to be a U.S. Senate member, addressing that body on the subject of the League of Nations. Pepper claims he was not really hypnotized, but was shamming, and that his speech wandered far from the assigned topic. Well, there are those today who claim he is still in a trance. But this time he fixes his mind on one subject, and that's protecting Social Security. Pepper was re-elected to the Senate in 1938 and 1944, but defeated for renomination in 1950 by an opponent who painted him as a communist sympathizer. Pepper then returned to practicing law in Miami. When a new congressional district was created there in 1962, he returned to Capitol Hill to stay. Re-elected to the House 10 times, he has served during the terms of every president in the last 50 years except Eisenhower. Congressman Pepper is legend as the foremost champion of the elderly, of Social Security, and Medicare. He is the only congressman who receives mail regularly from every district in the nation. Assured of his own re-election with a minimum of campaigning, he has spoken on behalf of more of his party's candidates than any other congressman. He is ubiquitous. If Claude Pepper has been no more successful than Ponce de Leon in finding the fountain of youth, he has discovered how to prolong life vigorously. 2 years ago, he reluctantly relinquished the chairmanship of the Select Committee on Aging in order to chair the powerful House Rules Committee, the one that decides which bills come to the House floor for a vote and which don't. As holder of this key post, as a member of the Democratic Steering and Policy Committee, and as one of the most respected legislators on the Hill, Congressman Pepper comes today to tell us what legislation the 99th Congress is likely to enact or not enact this year and next. The Honorable Claude Pepper.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Mr. President, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I'm profoundly grateful for the very generous words of introduction from the President, and even more indebted for the privilege of being here today. There are some of you who will recall one of the beloved figures who once was a part of our Washington, Alvin Barkley. Maybe some of you will recall one of his favorite stories about Bluebell. Bluebell was one of the horses entered in a race, the fifth race, in a race meet which Barkley said occurred in his bluegrass state of Kentucky one afternoon when there were five horses entered in the race. About 30 minutes before the race was to begin, a gentleman walked up to the pari-mutuel window, smacking his lips a little bit as if he'd been visiting with some of that good Kentucky bourbon, thrust a roll of bills under the window, and he said, "Give me $1,000 on Bluebell." They gave him the tickets, and he turned away. About 15 minutes later, he returned, smacking his lips a little faster, thrust another roll of bills under the window, and he said, "Give me another $1,000 on Bluebell." They gave him those tickets, and he turned away. Just before the race was to begin, he returned to the window, a little unsteady on his feet by that time, but he thrust another roll of bills under the window. He said, "Give me another $1,000 on Bluebell." They gave him the tickets, and he turned away.